2, tape 2, in Ruby, talking to Gladys. And this is the 11th, according to this calendar. So we were talking about philosophy of education. Or no, we weren't. We were talking about...
the history of Maryland Hot Springs.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Just after the tape went off, we said something about what it costs to run that school compared to nowadays. So, what was that for the record?
Well, when we first established, there was for the operation of the school itself, the physical plant. There was the building, a 16 by 20 log cabin building, the lights, the heat, the janitorial services were $100 a month. And this is because the lights were furnished through the Coleman lanterns. And when Chuck bought his own generator and provided electricity, then it cost the state $150 a month for the same services, but then included electricity. Right. And we taught I taught in that log cabin until the year when I had 19 students, because it was a 16 by 20 building. And was a bit crowded then. I can remember when I planned the Christmas program that year, I had to plan it so once the children were on stage, they wouldn't move for the remainder of the program, because there wouldn't be room for them to come and go off stage, because by the time the community came into that 16 by 20 building, and the 19 students performing, there wasn't room for much activity there. But that's when the state decided we needed a little bit more room. And Chuck built the house, the building that is our present house. And that was 52 by 26. And with plastic, the full length from floor to ceiling along 152-foot wall and half of each end, so it's 13 on each end, and then the full 52-foot length. And we had the school was one half of the building, and our home was the other half. And because it was one large open area, we had collected the blazer boxes, and in preparation for the school, we would stack those blazer boxes so they would be facing the classroom. They became essentially a partition then between our home, the living quarters, and the school, and also furnished floor-to-ceiling closet space for equipment. And it turned out to be a pretty good
you put this
way of handling.
Across your house, then? Across that long open room?
Crossways. So the school was 26 by 26 then. And the blazer boxes became the partition for the school year. And we left it open enough at one end so it would serve as a place to walk in between the two. And other than that, it was floor-to-ceiling cupboard space.
So you didn't have that partition you have in there now that runs lengthwise?
No. It was a very temporary type of partition. We put it up every fall for the school year. Then during the summer, we packed all of the school supplies into these boxes and put them into storage for the summer, along with the desks and the tables and so on. And then in the fall, we would unpack the stuff, and then we would use the whole building as our home in the summer, because we rented that space just for the school year. And then in each fall, we would unpack the stuff and put up this temporary partition again.
How did you like teaching in that kind of situation?
Well, it was a very convenient situation for me, because we had, it was very convenient. If I wanted to work at any time, day or night, I didn't have to get dressed and go to school. You know, school was right there. So it was very convenient, but we sacrificed much as far as the home was concerned, because Chuck would have to accommodate his activities in the home according to the fact that the school was right there. So the noise level always had to be considered whenever he had any people come to see him at home. And he, as a matter of fact, he discouraged any activity in the home other than just quiet social visiting during the day.
Well, so far these are both one-room schools that you're talking about. How do you feel about teaching in a one-room school?
Well, that's where my heart is. That's where it's been. And that's why I'm one of those fortunate people that had an opportunity to pursue their career in exactly the setting that they wanted it. If I had my choice of anything now, it would still be back in a one-room school, and of course in Hot Springs.
Why is it that one-room school is better?
I just have a feeling that I can perform my best in that kind of a situation. It's the greatest challenge for me, and I also see rewards in teaching in a one-room school that can't be duplicated elsewhere. Two of the main things that I've noticed in the years that I've taught in a one-room school, it's an ideal, you have a built-in system of review and preview, I call it. And so you have a built-in system for remedial type teaching and also for gifted or enrichment for the children. And it can be done, it's done every day in an ordinary classroom situation. So if you have a child who missed something, some concept along the way in math, in spelling, in any subject area, while you're teaching that concept at a lower level, they can easily be a part of that learning process, and it's done in a very unobtrusive way. All he has to do is just pay attention during that period of time while he needs that concept, and nobody but you or he need know it, and sometimes maybe not even you. And children have a way of perking their attention at times like this, and they do it almost naturally. They are aware of their needs. And the same thing is true in areas of enrichment. If there is an area in science, for example, that is going on at the upper grade level, that even a child at the primary level might suddenly become interested in. He simply quits doing what he's doing and pays attention during the time that that's going on. Sometimes you can become involved in an activity and the whole classroom will suddenly stop whatever they're doing and congregating in a circle around that activity. And because it is such it's a close-knit type situation, children can do this without being embarrassed about, a sixth, seventh, eighth grade student suddenly being interested in something that primary children might be doing. You know, they're just observers on the sidelines, although there are times when they can actually become active participants. And it isn't a concern. In fact, it's a joy to watch that type of thing where interest in it, it's a motivation, a built-in motivation system. And it also teaches you a lot of things. It can teach you sometimes that, or it can teach you that you are not aware of something that you should have been aware of. And
what would that be?
If a child suddenly becomes interested in an area that he needs and becomes either observation or active participation, becomes aware or involved in a situation that you thought he didn't have any interest in at all. And he shows you, you know, on his own, and you can take advantage of this kind of a situation. I had another situation where there was a girl who was above average ability, but for some reason she was a horrible speller. And this also showed in her reading. She was in oral reading, she was a very halting type reader. And she was in the sixth grade level. And, but she, now that was a situation where you knew that she needed a lot, but she also had been no doubt troubled by this weakness enough, so she didn't want to show it. She was one of the girls that came up from Oregon and was daughter of Hazel Deos by a previous marriage. And her mother told me later that she never wrote letters to her. And when I told her about her spelling deficiency, she said that was probably the reason why, that she didn't want to write because she was a girl of above average ability and she was aware of what a weak speller she was. So, but she definitely tried to cover it up with her other talents. So, in that situation, if there were, and she also was a very industrious child, so she could get involved in something and just not be aware of what was going on around her. Yeah, so in that kind of a situation, then you worked with a very definite purpose. And it would hardly do for me to take a girl out of a sixth grade speller and have her participate with children at grade levels three and four grade levels below her actual class level. So what I did there in a situation like that was just changed the room environment whenever I worked with the children. Instead of working with them at the opposite center of the room, I suddenly transferred my center over into the area where she was closest to it, and it would be distracting enough for her, so she became aware of the situation. But I never actually told her that that was the reason that I was there, you know, that I wanted her to participate. But then once she was aware of what we were doing, she became a daily student, essentially, in a very unobtrusive way of that class. And that year, well, we also did other things. We played a continuous game of Scrabble in the classroom. We just had the Scrabble board out and encouraged the use of dictionaries and this type of thing. And there was a phenomenal growth in her spelling ability that year, sufficiently so that we raised funds locally to get her to go to the spelling bee in Anchorage, and as a reward. And she went and she placed fifth, which was really great for her ego, because she was aware all through the year that she was, or when she came, that she was a weak speller. And
fifth statewide?
Mm-hmm. So that made her feel really good when she came back and did, you know, as much for her ego as anything would have done.
Now, I know in the 50s and 60s and even presently, some school systems believe in tracking students. That in, say, one particular grade level, they may have three achievement levels and put all the similar students together. What do you think about that?
In Fairbanks they had that system where they had them in separate rooms according to ability, you know. So there was remedial, average, and the children who received the enrichment. I don't believe in that. I have quite strong feelings about that now. I was really concerned with this situation when I was in Fairbanks. In the years we taught that I taught in Fairbanks, I had an opportunity to do some team teaching with another first grade teacher. First grade is my choice when I'm in a city school system. We both had enrollments of 30 to 35 first grade students. And it was her first year of teaching, and she had a couple of students that she was really concerned with, and she came and asked me for help with them. And I had four reading groups and four different math groups with my 30 students. She could also get hers divided into that number, but then there were two students that didn't fall in with anybody. And those were the two that she was concerned about. And what evolved, and it evolved almost naturally, after we began working together, we took all of our students, and we were able to place them into six reading groups. And so we would exchange students, and we found that every 2 weeks was a good way to do it. So the students were exposed to the teaching of both of us. But the two students that didn't go anywhere, didn't belong in any group, those we each handled daily because of they had a short attention span, for one thing. So one of us would work with them each day, and then the other one would take them also the same day on the same material, but we weren't concerned with the techniques that each one of us used, only to the extent that we always wanted to know what the other was doing, you know. But as far as it influencing any technique that we might use, it didn't. And so there was that immediate reinforcement of whatever they learned that day. And we kept statistics on the growth of these students. And it was amazing to see the results. There were some children who were in the lowest group, not talking about these two, but that of the six group that were in the lowest of the six groups that ended up in the highest at the end of the year. There were some who were in that highest group that fell a group or two, and there was quite a leap in some of the students. And you could see what would have happened if those children would have been slotted into a certain room where they would have been, okay, these are your remedial students, these are your average, and these are your gifted. They would have been in that room for all of that year. And at the end of that year, they would have gone on to second, but they would have still been in the slower or whichever one of the three groups. By the time they do that for two or three years, they are so far behind that then they really do belong there. And I just don't think it is a very democratic system.
Yeah, well, I agree with you. Okay, in a one-room school, then, when you have as great a variety as you can possibly have in the classroom, what do you do about discipline problems?
Well, first of all, you have to determine yourself what standard of discipline you want in your classroom, and I am a strict disciplinarian. But I establish that fact right from the beginning, and also I maintain a reputation for it. So, because the first job that you're there for is to create an atmosphere where children can learn. And you are not going to do it in a disruptive environment. And it's always easier to establish on that strict level. Then from there on, you just proceed with the philosophy that they get as much freedom as they can handle. And you give them the responsibility and the freedom and see how they handle it. And it makes your job a lot easier, and it makes a lot easier for them too, I think.
Do you find it difficult to control students when you may be working on something that's three or four grades removed from where they are, that you have to leave them working by themselves a lot?
No. I really stress the independent work habits. And by the time a child, and you start them right there at the first grade level, and if a child has had even a 1 year in school where he didn't have these, it shows up and it takes a long time to correct these. It takes a lot longer sometimes than the period it took to establish these sloppy habits. Because essentially what you have to do is unlearn and then reteach these habits. So they lose a lot of time in between there. But if they start off right from the beginning, by the time a child is in the upper primary, and even the first year, you can get some children who have some really admirable self-discipline and work-study habits. And in the one-room school situation, you have to have that, because by the time they're moving along at the, you're concentrating with the children who are coming to school for the first time at the beginning primary ages, you're concentrating with them a lot on a one-to-one level. It's absolutely necessary. And you couldn't possibly give that time if you have a whole room full of upper primary, intermediate, and upper grade children who cannot sit down and do their work. That doesn't mean that they don't need to come to you. They do, and they do constantly, but it has to be done with a certain organization. So the way I handle the one-room school situation is to make it completely individualized. As far as they are at a certain grade level, you know, you will have so many sixth graders, but you won't have so many sixth graders working in sixth grade subjects. You know, they're working at different levels over, above, and at their grade level. But they're on an individual basis, and it's very flexible, and they move at their own speed. And you just let that child go at whatever speed he's capable of performing.
Well, how do you handle promotion in a situation like that?
It's still very standardized. So I have had children who were working at a high school level and they were still at eighth grade level. And I have children who have worked below their grade level, and you still promote them, but it's a social promotion. It's when it's below grade level. I don't believe that much is gained by keeping a child in one grade for 4 or 5 years to get him to perform on grade level according to standardized testing. There are some students who would be in the fourth grade for 8 years, you know. Performing below grade level, it's a social promotion. But I haven't felt guilty about keeping children at a grade level when they're performing above grade level.
Do you feel that comes from your own experience?
Yes, I would say it is. Although I have double promoted. I haven't double promoted in Hot Springs, although I did get one student there who was two grades below his level when I received him, but that was simply because he didn't he was supposed to be working on correspondence, and he just was in a situation where it wasn't being done. And it wasn't that he didn't have the ability. And in 2 years, he did essentially a four-year job for me. But he was a very special student, and he was industrious and very concerned. And when you have that type of student, you're going to do whatever you can for him.
What do you feel is the maximum number of students you could handle in a one-room situation?
That's a hard question to answer, because if you had asked me if I would have had those children from the time they were in the first grade, or if they would be students that were coming from another school that would be able to adjust to my standards of discipline, then I could handle alone. Oh, I don't know. That just is an impossible question. You know, you're going to have to ask me. Yeah, you're going to have to tell me who my students are, and then I'll tell you how many I can answer.
Okay,
I could take care of.
Say the optimum situation.
Optimum. Well, you know how you feel about teaching. You always feel anyway that there aren't enough hours in the day or enough days in the school year to do everything that you wanted to do. So now I have to throw the question at you, what optimum as far as a basic education?
Well, say I'm sure that you could walk into a room and there'd be four real problem kids and that'd be too many, and there might be 20 that aren't problem kids and that'd be all right.
Right.
But what I'm looking for is a kind of like, could you have 35 kids in there, even if they were well behaved?
If they were very well behaved, but I would certainly have it on my conscience. I wish I had a few more hours.
Right. So you
in the school day.
What would be the best size classroom that would be not too few or too many students?
One time in Hot Springs, my enrollment dropped below 10 for just a short period. And I thought that was too little, you know, too few. When I had 19, and they were a beautiful, beautiful group of children to work with. But then I've taught, you know, I've had the fortune of having the best kids in Alaska to work with, you know, too. So, I remember when I had 19, the year I had 19, it was a busy, busy year. But I felt good about the achievement of the children that year. And although you never feel that you give them everything they deserve. But I didn't feel too guilty about, I didn't feel that there was also any area of neglect, except music. And I've always felt neglectful in that area.
Now, just one last question on discipline before we get on to something else. Could you describe a situation in which you would be disciplining some student? You know, how would you go about doing it? I mean, sometimes teachers use paddles. Sometimes they hang them by their thumbs. I don't know what they do.
No, I don't believe in paddling. I have, but I also can say that I can see where it's necessary for some to do it. I don't condemn it. But for me, I have done it once in 20 years. And that was the method that used at home. And I had, and it was a problem child. And the problem was, he was a big boy, and he liked to pick on the little kids, particularly the girls. And there was physical safety involved. And I had worked with him all year, and it was in March, late March, and I had told him at that time, I said, that I have tried everything with you that it is in my knowledge to know, and that if a situation occurred again where there would be a physical abuse of another child, then I didn't know what else to do but in turn to physically abuse him. And I told him that would be a spanking. And of course, he knew that I had never spanked a child. And it was on a day when I needed to be inside of the school to help another child during the lunch hour. And because I always went out with my children. But there was another adult there who said that she would watch them for that short period while I was going to be inside. And she came in and told me that he had become, they were playing kickball. And one of the bases was a tree in the schoolyard. And there was a girl who was the baseman, and he came, she got him out. And he became so infuriated at her when she got him out, that she took her by the head and started banging her head against the tree. And so the woman came in running to me and told me, you know, what he was doing. And so I sent the child out, and I told the children to stay outside, and I said that this was the situation that we had been talking about. And so I had to spank him. But it was a horrible feeling. It was more horrible for me, I know, than it was for him, because I know that this happened to him all the time at home, you know, with far worse whipping instruments than I had, which I used one of those light yardsticks, you know, not the good material. And I decided then that I knew that I would never do it again, because doing it that one time was really traumatic for me. And it didn't solve anything. Although it did solve that problem for the rest of the year, I did not have a problem with it. But it was such a traumatic experience for me that I knew I could never do it again.
But what sort of things would you find would work then?
Well, you know, I have a loud voice. And I always let the children know that I don't believe in this philosophy that I've heard many times, and I've had run-ins with other educators about this idea that you have to have ultimate patience with in the classroom. To me, it's necessary for the children to know that we have emotions too, and that we can have good days as well as bad days, but also that we should be able to talk to them about it, and they should be able to talk to us about it. And if a child displeases me, I want him to know that he's displeasing me. But on the other hand, if a child pleases me, it's just as necessary for me to tell him that. And it doesn't bother me for a child to know that I'm very angry with him about something that he did. And I can love him, and I can cry with him, and laugh with him, and be mad at him, you know, depending upon the situation. And I hope, and I encourage them to be able to do the same to me, you know.
So you feel like you get really emotionally involved with your
kids? Yeah, really. Mm-hmm.
Is that different than other teachers might do?
I don't know.
That's an odd question.
Is it?
Yeah. Let's see. So how do you get your reputation as a fire-breathing dragon?
Well, by being a very strict disciplinarian. Just the fact that children know exactly what they can get by with me and what they can't. I mean, there is that line that they know that they just better not walk over. I mean, they might be able to do it with the next teacher that comes along, but they don't want to do it with me. They might try it with me, but they don't. I'm really very emphatic about them knowing that, and I call it the wall of security with them. So I've had little small primary children. When the public health nurse used to come to Manly Hot Springs, they would say, "I don't want to take my shot at home." They said, "I want to take my shot at school. It doesn't hurt as much." And I know a lot of that is just indoctrination, you know. I tell them, like there was a little girl who she was just horribly frightened of taking a shot, or, you know, getting a shot. And her mother told me she's going to throw a tantrum. And so I was prepared for it. And so I told the public health nurse about it. And I said, but I want to talk to her about it, but I don't want to do it until just before she gets her shot. So I told her, I said, that we were going to have the shots that day, and when we had it, I said, I want you to really concentrate, and I want you to concentrate on it like you do, just like you have, you know, when you have a hard problem in school, and I've told you, you've got to get it done, and you know how to do it, and you do it by yourself. And said that she was to look out the window as soon as... you know, she was going to get her shot. I said, look out that window and look at that tree and think about it as hard as you can. And that's all you're thinking about. And while you're doing it, you start counting. And you start... And I said, start counting. And I said, by the time you count to 10, I said, it'll be all over with. Well, of course, it didn't even take 10, you know. But I said, and you know that you're hardly going to feel it. But I said, you have to think hard about that tree and count to 10. And she did, and we had no tantrum. You know? And after that, we didn't. Another thing I believe in is being very specific, carry through with what you're specific about, give them as much freedom as they're responsible for. So by the time, it wasn't very long before I was in Hot Springs, and we lived by one rule. There was only one rule that we had that the children had to remember. And that was, don't do anything that would make somebody else unhappy or unsafe. And all they had to do was to think about this. You don't run in the classroom because you're going in, because those classrooms were small, you know, and the desk and the metal divider in the middle of the room on the floor was something that they stumbled on a lot. So if you're running, that was an easy thing to stumble over. So if you didn't run in the classroom because there wasn't room to do it, because it could cause an accident, you know, either to themselves or to somebody else. If you wanted to run, it was fine to run, but you did it outdoors where it was safe to do so. So you were very